Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I'm fortunate to have Dr. Ray Goodwin back with me tonight. Ray's made a previous appearance on the Heretics Hour. It was on June 7th. You know you can look back for that page for a picture and a little bio on him. He's affectionately known as Professor Ray Goodwin to many, and he certainly lives up to that title. Hello, Ray. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Carolyn. I appreciate that. It's nice to be back.
Well, good. Now, before we get on to our main topic, I want to just touch on a couple of things in the news that I just can't pass by. And one is this Thilo Sarrazin, who is, to me, has become a true German. He's really speaking out. He's a banker. He's a member of the Bundesbank. He's one of the central bank members in Germany. And he's been speaking out for some time, but now his book has come out. I don't know if it just came out, but he's held a press conference, and he has said a couple of things. His book is titled, it kind of translates into something like, Germany Abolishes Itself. And, of course, his theme has been for some time that the immigration, that the kind of immigrants coming into Germany are doing damage to Germany. They're not integrating. They're bringing down the educational standards. And he also, in this interview at least, he talks about the different genetic makeup of different races and groups and national groups of people and so on. And he mentioned the Jews having a distinctive gene. Well, that's enough to set the Jews crazy. And the title of this one article, which was on the website of a diamond company, and they put out financial news, is that Germany's central bank votes to oust Sarrazin for Jew comments. That's all they pay attention to. And yet they continually talk, don't they, about the qualities of the Jews, of the Jewish genetic makeup being distinctive. And they talk about that, and they write articles about that. But if somebody else mentions it, you know, they use that as a reason to get rid of him. So all this is coming down on this guy. And Merkel says, I can't accept these comments. They have an exclusionary effect. And the president of the Bundesbank, Axel Weber, has now said that they're going to oust this guy from the Bundesbank. But the thing I want to point out, and why this is going to be so interesting, is that this man has said in this to the press, he said, I know my employment contract, that's for sure. He said, a Bundesbank board member has the right to freely express himself also on topics which are not work-related. So obviously, hopefully, he's going to fight this. He's not going to just go down like most of them do. He's going to stand up for himself, and boy, I sure hope he does. This is something to watch.
That's right. That's unusual.
And yes. It's great. I'm all for him.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Then in another story that just came out is that Simon Wiesenthal, a new book has come out by Tom Segev, which supposedly reveals, although we already knew it, but it reveals that Wiesenthal was a Mossad agent. And he talks about how Israel did more to capture Nazi war criminals than was previously known, and that the Mossad financed the establishment of Wiesenthal's office in Vienna and paid him some $300 a month in cash as wages. Well, this is very interesting to me because I've been doing a lot of research on Elie Wiesel, and I'm sure that he was paid by the Mossad also, and he's done work for the Mossad, and he's basically another agent. He may not be doing that much now, but he's always been available to them, and when he was a young journalist and going around the world, he was probably functioning for them to some degree. How helpful he could have been is another thing, but you know, this I thought was pretty good, so that's another thing to be paying attention to.
Sure.
Well, what we want to talk about tonight is to carry on with my theme here of who is responsible for World War II. And you have some very unique insights into some of the things that were going on between Churchill and Roosevelt before the war even broke out, before 39 even, and before America went into the war. And this is what we want to go into tonight. So you have introduced me to a couple of articles in the Journal of Historical Review back from an issue in 1983, which I've read. And the main discussion here is going to revolve around the Witocki papers, which were Polish diplomatic papers that Germans found in Warsaw when they took over Poland. And also information that came from Mr. Tyler Kent, who was a code clerk at the American Embassy in London, working for Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, and then further what comes from that. So, Ray, explain first, I think, maybe to our listeners, what are the Witocki papers?
Well, Count Jerzy Witocki was the Polish ambassador to the United States. And as such, of course, he handled the dealings between the two governments, and he dealt with the U.S. State Department and Franklin Roosevelt. And it was obvious to Witocki from as early as 1937 that Franklin Roosevelt was very, very keen on getting a European war started, primarily for economic means for the United States, because his New Deal had floundered and the country was still struggling along mightily with unemployment and all, and Roosevelt being the true capitalist, communist, if you either want to apply or both, felt that the best and quickest out from that would be a war in which he could involve the United States. And the Witocki papers were illustrative of the very fact that Roosevelt was trying to urge and incite animosity between Poland and Germany from the very start. And they revealed underhanded dealings and words that totally contradicted Roosevelt's public appearance and pronouncements. And those documents were, of course, sent to Warsaw and collected there over a couple of years until the war started. And as you said, when Germany took over Warsaw, they captured those documents before they could be destroyed. And they were very incriminatory about the shenanigans of Roosevelt with Biddle and other American diplomats in Europe in trying to foment war. And so naturally, when the Germans came out with those in a white paper, so to speak, they were quickly denounced as forgeries and German propaganda and kind of brushed aside and just left alone by historians and all for decades. But that's essentially what those papers were about. They were really a confirmation of the suspicions of some people all along that it was not Germany that was responsible for the outbreak in 1939 of what became World War II. And so those papers, the Witocki papers, really dovetail very nicely into the Tyler Kent story.
Yeah, before you start that, let me point out to the listeners that there's a very good article about these called The Secret mm-hmm. Polish Documents at the IHR.org website, and the title of it is President Roosevelt's Campaign to Incite War in Europe, The Secret Polish Documents by Mark Weber. And it's very long and very detailed, and they can go there and find it. So.
Sure.
In the first place, let's make it real clear that it was rather inappropriate, well, quite inappropriate, for the President of the United States to be communicating in this way with Churchill, who at that time was what? Lord of the Admiralty. He wasn't Prime Minister.
Lord of the Admiralty. It's equivalent to our Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah. And instead of talking to the Prime Minister, who at that time was Chamberlain, correct?
Right.
He was instead communicating about intimate details of how they were going to conduct things with this Secretary of the Navy, so to speak. So they had this relationship going, and it was not according to what our president should be doing, and it was secret. Of course, they didn't want any of this known, so as you said, they denied everything. And it's pointed out that at that time, people were much more willing to believe everything the government told them than we are today.
Very good point. Yes.
Thanks to the internet. And and also things that have happened. He uses the example of Vietnam and the Watergate affair, which really shocked everyone that, oh my God, our president told a lie. Then we go on to Clinton, and he lied, about the Monica Lewinsky,
and
he's going to be impeached because presidents don't lie. Well, of course, as we become more sophisticated, we know that presidents lie all the time, and these people were all lying at that time. So, so now you want to go on to Tyler Kent.
Yeah, well, Carolyn, your series there on who was responsible for World War II, you've directed attention towards Stalin and addressed Churchill. And now we talk about FDR, it's my own conclusion, and has been for decades, that he has to be labeled the primary instigator and the cause of that war. Now, certainly the British had their, they call it the balance of power policy, that they wanted to maintain, which simply meant if any European nation dared arise that would in the least challenge Britain's superiority economically, in trade, in products, quality of products, then that country had to be slapped down. And for a long time, for a couple of centuries, that nation was France. And Germany began its economic revival and became a very viable modern nation along probably in the late 1890s to 1900, right in there, and then just grew. And then, of course, under National Socialism really took off. And that frightened the heck out of the very imperialistic British. And so their efforts began to say, okay, we've got to stop Germany and put it down somehow, no matter what it costs, because we've got to maintain the British Empire. So you had that faction in England that was totally anti-German and wanted to destroy National Socialism and Germany. And you had adherence to that, and certainly Churchill fit that prominently. So did this Lord Halifax, who very unfortunately was given control of British foreign policy by Chamberlain in about October of 1938. And Halifax was, in my own words, a mad dog as far as wanting to incite war and totally rejecting anything conciliatory or peaceful nature coming out of Germany. And so you had this Halifax, Churchill, Roosevelt combination. Now, Halifax would not have even considered going to war with Germany without a guarantee that France was going to jump in, and they also were working to get the Soviet Union to come in with them.
Mm-hmm.
But Halifax, like I say, wouldn't have done that without the assurances from Franklin Roosevelt that the United States would certainly jump in with both feet and back up any British effort to crush Germany. And he was getting those guarantees as, through Churchill, who was dealing with Franklin Roosevelt. And as you mentioned, certainly at the least, the most egregious violation of protocol, of diplomatic protocol, because here you have the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, dealing directly with the U.S. President. Now, the way I found out about that was through, first of all, Mr. Tyler Kent, and then the Pataki papers just substantiated and backed up everything that Mr. Kent had told me and had written about. And Tyler Kent was the decoding clerk working for Joseph Kennedy, our ambassador in London. And what his job was to decode messages coming from the United States to the British government, and he would decode those messages. He was ordered to deliver them in those messages because they were addressed to Winston Churchill. And then when Churchill replied, his job was to encode that message and send it back to Franklin Roosevelt. So this so-called lowly clerk in the offices of our embassy was privy to these dealings. And Tyler Kent was very much the patriot, very concerned American with what he was reading, totally contradicted what Franklin Roosevelt was saying about maintaining peace and not sending our boys into any foreign wars, I assure you, et cetera, et cetera. And it disturbed him what he was reading.
Yeah, and let's make it clear, though, that Tyler Kent, he did have political views, and he was, what would you say, associated with the thinking in the U.S. of
America First
labeled
committee.
Isolation. Yeah, the American First.
Yes.
And, Did he have connections with these conservative groups and no war groups in Britain at that
yes.
time or afterward? Yeah. What?
Yes. And that was part of his growth in learning what was going on. When he started decoding these messages and reading them, Kent was occasionally invited socially to parties of diplomats and things like this as the clerk. And he started hearing conversations. He made friends with several prominent people in England and realized that there was also a very concerned bunch of Englishmen over there, just like Charles Lindbergh, Senator Burton Wheeler, our America's First Committee over here, very concerned about the pot that was starting to boil to get a war started. And there were British people over there who were very patriotic as well and concerned about their own country, and they knew, those people knew, Kent quickly found out that any war between Germany and England could only result in a ruin for Europe and for both nations, and the only winner out of that would be the USSR. So Kent made friends with Minister of Parliament Archibald Ramsay and a handful of others, and he decided to share the messages that he was decoding and encoding with this small group of British patriots. So they knew as well. He would show those to the British patriots, and they realized that their government was also determined to start a war, that elements in their government, and that primarily it was Halifax and Churchill. And so just as Tyler Kent, his goal was to take those messages to get enough of them, because he said that had he come over here in person and testified before Congress that I've read this and whatever without any substantiation, he would have been ignored, laughed at, pushed aside. So his job in what he was trying to do in copying those messages was to get proof, have the physical proof with him, if he could deliver, get those messages delivered to the U.S. Congress, maybe even through Charles Lindbergh, and expose Roosevelt's warmongering under the table. Well, his British friends wanted to do the same thing regarding Winston Churchill and embarrass them and maybe even get Roosevelt impeached, but that was their goal. And Mr. Kent had decoded, I asked him at one time how many, you know, and he shook his head. He said, I don't really know. He said, I've even read that it's 1,500 to 1,800, and he said, that's probably pretty accurate.
Well, you might explain here, Ray, how you knew him and how you were asking him questions.
Yeah, I read that issue of the IHR that you mentioned, that 1983 issue, and there were three key articles, and one of them was by Tyler Kent. And it was so fascinating as Kent told his story for the first time in that book. And
okay, and this article is also, for the listeners, available now. It's available on the Internet at the IHR website, and the title of it is The Roosevelt Legacy and the Kent Case.
Yeah, and I would
can read this.
Certainly, I would urge everybody to read that. And anyway, at the end of the three articles, Carolyn, there was a a small blurb on each of the contributors. And on Tyler Kent, it talked a little bit about Kent and his job with the American Diplomatic Corps, and it said Mr. Kent is currently at his home in Texas. Well, that just floored me because, you know, being here in Texas all my life, I thought, my goodness, I'd love to meet that fella. And so I sent a letter to the IHR and asked if they could put me in contact with Tyler Kent. And they wrote back and said they had forwarded my letter to him. And I was very excited and anxiously awaiting a note from Mr. Kent, which did not come for maybe 6 weeks. And I had kind of put it out of my mind and forgotten about it. And I came to the conclusion after 2 or 3 weeks that he probably did not want to be bothered. And then I got this note in the mail, and it said, "Dear Goodwin," he always called me by my last name. He said, "My apologies for not getting in touch sooner," but he said, "I've been relocating from my home in Harlingen, Texas, which is down in the valley close to Mexico, and about 200 miles from me." And he said, "I've relocated to Kerrville, Texas, which is about 170 miles or so from me to the northwest." And so we began a correspondence. And that's how I got to know Tyler Kent, and then I invited him to Victoria. He came over here a couple of times, stayed in my home, gave talks to my little circle of friends. And anyway, that's how I came to know on a personal basis this gentleman who was like one person away from Joseph Stalin when he was working in our embassy in Moscow doing the same kind of work. And then with delivering these messages to Winston Churchill, decoding these messages from Franklin Roosevelt. So, you know, Carolyn, when you're dealing with first-hand information, someone who was there, someone who saw, someone who participated, it's a bit different than reading something out of a book and then having my own college professor of history when I was going through to get my degrees, when I would make remarks on some of my papers that I turned in, including some of the information that Kent had given me, he would say stuff like, "I would question the source of this information," you know, and which is hilarious to me. But at any rate, that's how I came to know Tyler Kent and the information which I got and which he talked about. And unfortunately for the whole world, there was an intelligence agent among his British friends. And they became aware
naturally
of
it. Isn't there always?
Absolutely. And anyway, they found out, and so Kent said he was at home about 10 a.m. one morning in his little cold water flat there in England, and they came in smashing in the door, British officials from Scotland Yard and one underling from the U.S. Embassy. And he said, you know, all they had to do was knock on the door. He said, I would have opened the door for them, but they were very dramatic, smashed my door down, came in and told me I was under arrest. He said, I didn't know what for or by whom for a while.
And well, had Tyler Kent managed to pass some of these actual word-for-word messages to his English friends?
Yes, he had. Now, the thing about that is, it's a little bit unclear to me, Carolyn, in all honesty. Mr. Kent didn't tell me if he gave copies to Archibald Ramsey, the Minister of Parliament, or if he just verbally passed on the information, or showed them to him, but without giving them to him, because there's never any mention about when Ramsey was arrested, any documents in his possession. And so I'm not sure if that circle of British patriots had copies of those messages or not. I kind of think it was more of an oral thing.
Have wanted to be in possession of Bush.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You see, because Kent was in a little bit different position. His country was not yet at war. Of course, after September of 39, and that's when he arrived in the embassy in London from Moscow. The British were in the war, and so his circle of friends had to be very, very careful because their country was at war, and they could immediately be labeled traitors, spies, things like this. So they had to be much more discreet. And so you're right. That's a good point. I don't think that they would have wanted possession of such documents, but they were certainly working to, because the war had not really erupted into the savage affair that it became at that point. And there was also that the false war, the phony war, as they called it, into 1940 when actually militarily things were just at a standstill. And there was a hope to bring the thing to a conclusion at that point. And that's the point at which Mr. Kent was most effective over there in trying to do what he was doing. But with his arrest, and they took him, he said they took him to the embassy. He had to go see Joseph Kennedy. And he said that Kennedy was furious and really ranted and raised hell. But in all honesty, from my visits with Mr. Kent, he conveyed to me the impression that Kennedy was much more upset that he got caught than with what he had actually done. Because Joseph Kennedy was also trying to avoid a war with Germany, and he kept trying to moderate, but he had a job to do. And he had to deliver Roosevelt's bellicose messages to other American ambassadors to deliver to Poland, France, whatever. And he didn't care for the way things were going. But anyway,
that's
so Kent's his diplomatic immunity was waived. And, you know, ironically, he had committed no crime, broken no laws. He wasn't supposed to. He was allowed to make copies of the messages, but not really to take them for his own use.
Okay. Ray, we have to take a break now.
Okay.
So we'll be back in a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, so stay tuned.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR. ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, most people in the U.S. will be celebrating Labor Day this Monday by having barbecues, parades, back-to-school shopping, but back in 1882, this holiday was all about a celebration of something else. Workers' rights, about legally beating oppression in the workplace. So, why the change in sentiment? RT's Jihan Hafiz reports.
Labor Day, a time when Americans can kick back and relax, enjoy the last days of summer, and prepare for the school year. But that wasn't always the case.
The international movement for labor's rights has its roots here in the United States. Your average American worker has an 8-hour work day, benefits, and the support of labor unions. All of it would not have been possible if it weren't for the radical workers' movement of the late 1800s, when America was experiencing an era of industrialization and worker exploitation.
In 1886, federal trade and labor unions declared May 1st a national day of strikes, protests, and endless demonstrations. The actions ignited labor movements all over the country, culminating in the infamous Haymarket Massacre in Chicago. It was this moment that eventually gave the American worker the 8-hour workday and sparked a global movement for workers, now celebrated every year on May 1st, or May Day. Every year, May Day has become a time for workers worldwide to rise up against what they deem as corrupt employers, corporations, and banks. But the U.S. government has never honored May Day as a national labor holiday because of fears of associating itself with socialism around the world. Instead, the first Monday of September became the nationally recognized Labor Day.
So there were many decades of struggle, and the U.S. government knew very well that it was led by socialists who, you know, were the greatest, most militant, most stalwart fighters for workers' rights.
Another influential force of the American workers' movement was trade and labor unions. In their infancy, they had no affiliation to political parties. But today,
unfortunately, many union leaders today are very much tied to the Democratic Party.
During his election campaign, Barack Obama promised labor unions he would pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which would empower employees to join or form their own unions.
Following the election, President Obama and the Democrats in Congress reneged on their promises, and the labor union has accepted that and has backed off pushing for the Employee Free Choice Act.
Sarah suggests the country's more mainstream unions have been neutralized in their bargaining abilities with employers. As a result, they have become part of the establishment.
We've begun reversing and replacing old anti-labor executive orders, policies with ones that protect your benefits and protect your safety and protect your rights to organize and collectively bargain.
They don't have a broader perspective of what is truly in workers' interests, which would be an alternative to capitalism. And because of that, it greatly hinders the struggle when they accept being held back by the Democratic Party.
So as Americans celebrate the struggles of the labor movements in this country, one has to wonder how much progress has been made since American workers fought and died for their rights. Jehan Hafiz, RT, Washington, D.C.
And Jehan joins me now for more. So, Jehan, I hear you have some inside information as to what President Barack Obama will be doing this Monday, this Labor Day.
Well, it's not necessarily inside information, but...
Oh, come on, give yourself some credit.
All right, well...
He didn't call you and tell you himself?
Unfortunately not, but, however, he will be in doing a series of different gigs in Chicago and Cleveland, Ohio. He's going to be addressing the AFL-CIO, which is something he actually does every year, one of the unions that we talk about in the story, and then he's heading to Cleveland, Ohio to give remarks about the economy, because as we know...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My guest tonight is Ray Goodwin, and we are discussing the lead-up to World War II and the overall responsibility for how World War II became World War II, so to speak. He was just telling us about his friendship with Tyler Kent, and then going over the way that Tyler Kent was found out to be copying these messages that he was decoding from Roosevelt and back to Roosevelt, between Roosevelt and Churchill, and how he was arrested. So please continue with this very interesting account, Ray.
Okay. Kent was arrested, and his diplomatic immunity was waived, and he was charged with violating some security law, British security law. And they held his little trial in camera, which means in private. And he was convicted and put in prison on the Isle of Wight for the remainder of the war. And this was in May of 1940. And ironically, it was at the time shortly after Dunkirk had occurred, so Britain was really reeling and rocking. But anyway, Kent was put in jail and in his prison cell there. And I asked him about that stay in that prison, and he said he was treated well. He said he was given a daily newspaper. There was no abuse, but he said all of his correspondence was monitored and censored, and he was limited in what he could do. Mm-hmm. And he was in prison for, as I said, until the war was over, and they released him in, I believe it was November of 1945, and he was allowed to come back to the United States. But he did tell me that when he came back here, you know, they had still kind of under house arrest, if you might call it that. He was taken to the State Department, and he was interviewed, and he was told, given his orders, that he was never to speak of anything that he had witnessed, read, whatever, or that he would be brought up on charges of treason, and that he would be facing death, possibly the death sentence for being a traitor. And he said when he left Washington, D.C., from that day on, and he told me this in 1983, he said from that day on he has been monitored by the ADL, and they've kept tabs on him. He had been asked to give talks here and there, whatever, but he had to be very measured in what he said. Because he knew that there would be an ADL representative there, of course, keeping tabs on him. And if he said anything that they considered out of line, they could still bring him up on charges of treason. So he had to
Why would it be the ADL? I mean,
well, because several of those messages contained information about Jewish influence and the keys to wanting Germany and Hitler destroyed. And it didn't reflect well on them with their power and their influence. And even with Roosevelt, his advisors, Roosevelt's advisors, of course, Brandeis and Morgenthau, Rosenman, whatever. And so it didn't reflect well on them. But Kent had developed a very jaundiced view of the Jews when he was in the service of the embassy in Moscow. And he had to deal with mostly Jews because they held the positions of authority in the Soviet Union at that time. And he was very turned off by their arrogance and their attitudes. And so he had his own feelings, and so did Joseph Kennedy, as far as that goes. But at any rate, Kent was confined and then turned loose and came home. And he finally told his story really for the first time in that 1983 article. So we get back to Roosevelt, his responsibility. You know, and the third article in that magazine by David Hogan, H-O-G-G-A-N, really, really goes into that aspect. And quoting here, he says, the Polish ambassador was informed by William Bullitt, the American ambassador to France, who was visiting in the United States, that President Roosevelt was determined to bring America into the next European war. Now, that's iterated throughout that article, and the reason would be, of course, that Roosevelt's economic policies had failed, and he knew that putting this country on a war footing would certainly boost the economy, and also, he was very vainglorious, as everyone knew, and he wanted to be elected for that third term in 1940 when the elections rolled around, and if the country were involved in war, they'd be reluctant to change leaders. And so it was just his nature. And, you know, we were talking earlier about Hitler being quite different from most others, leaders and politicians in England, the United States, which is certainly a true statement. And their attitude was very negative towards him and towards his system of government. And propaganda was always pushed against Germany. But those other politicians had misread Hitler. And their intelligence reports about the German ability to fight a war, to sustain a war, to even win a war, were always just totally, no, he can't do it. At the most, he would settle down into a trench warfare against France, get bogged down in Europe there until he was so weakened that Russia could then jump on him and wipe him out. And it was that sort of attitude. It was a very condescending towards Germany and
Well, just like the Poles. The Poles really believed that they could defeat Germany if they wanted that war. They wanted
that's exactly right.
And belligerency to continue.
Sure.
And they thought they could do it on their own almost, but they also knew that they had France and England backing them up, and they expected more backing from them. But here I have a thing, speaking of this, there's a quote from this article. President Roosevelt was the first person to express hatred against fascism. I found that interesting. Fascism was something that was supposedly started in Italy with Mussolini, and it was kind of accepted to a degree. You know, I mean, it wasn't like totally demonized, but at some point they began to demonize fascism, and then they started saying that the National Socialists were fascists, and Germany had turned fascist, which to me is a mislabeling. But he was trying to get America to accept a vast armament program by demonizing, spreading rumors and so on about threats in Europe. But the main thing I wanted to add in here was that in 1939, Bullitt, who was U.S. ambassador to France and a special friend of FDR, William Bullitt, he was a nasty guy. He said in these Pataki papers, he said to one of the Polish people, diplomats, if war breaks out, we shall not take part in it at the beginning, but we shall finish it. He said this in February 1939.
Right.
And in March 1939, the Polish ambassador to the U.S. wrote in a message to Poland, Roosevelt continues to make clear that U.S. will support the democracies in event of war.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to get that in there, that he was...
And, as I said, FDR's New Deal, according to...
Yes, yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, he was jealous of Hitler.
Yes.
Because Hitler, as a leader, had done in Germany what Roosevelt had failed to do.
Yes,
in the U.S.
Yes, and under much worse, more severe consequences. Mm-hmm. The German Depression, you know, as bad as ours was, the German Depression was worse, much worse. And when the National Socialist government took over and instituted its policies, what that government did, number one, was take control of the German money supply away from its Jewish masters, just like ours is under the so-called Federal Reserve, and put that policy in the hands of the Germans themselves. That was the key to their economic recovery, and they started coming out of the doldrums rapidly. And Roosevelt was very jealous of that, and as his reforms through the New Deal towards ending the Depression were not coming to fruition, he was counting on the outbreak of a European war. And another interesting point that Hogan made, he said Roosevelt, Hull, and their advisors, anybody in their entourage who did not declare that Hitler was hopelessly insane was virtually ostracized. So any voice of sanity at that time, you know, it was not allowed. And that's kind of the way it is today. You can't speak favorably of any national leader who dares to stand up to this bunch of international criminals. And it says here Stalin...
Well, yeah, just like this Sarrazin that I mentioned at the beginning. I mean, is it. You see, if he says a single word against what they're... agenda is, even in spite of the fact that they're showing themselves to be totally breaking their own rules, you know, of how things operate, and you know, and that they're not a democratic country and that they don't allow any other points of view to be spoken by anybody who has any position whatsoever. It's just an example of that. Still, that's still what we're dealing with.
Yeah, and you know, Roosevelt had this conversation with Stalin in Tehran in 1943, and he made mention of that silly thing about Hitler being insane to Stalin. And boy, Stalin rebutted him immediately, you know, saying, hey, you know, we can end this talk right now because this man is not insane, definitely not insane. And what Stalin, his impression was out of that was that Roosevelt was just a unscrupulous politician just like all the rest, like himself, and who lacked any qualities as a statesman. And so the responsibility of Franklin Roosevelt, to me, is paramount in being the cause of the disaster that became World War II. And certainly number one was his goal of destroying Germany and Adolf Hitler. He was very jealous of Hitler, as you brought out, because Hitler's programs of turning his nation around economically were working. Roosevelt's had been a failure. So you had him dealing, as Mr. Kent revealed, underhandedly trying to get a war started over there and urging the Poles to resist even the most conciliatory offers of Hitler regarding Danzig and the Polish Charter. You had his, the same...
Yes, now let's make this very clear that at that time when these very important negotiations were going around in between Poland, Germany, Britain, and whoever else might have been involved, but mainly those, Roosevelt was pressing from his, you know, from over across the ocean, saying, don't go along with, don't make it. He was pressing the Poles
not to
go along with any agreements with Germany. He was pressing Britain.
Yes.
Put some iron up the spine of those Poles and don't let this happen. I don't want any agreements. And while he was doing that, he is promising or implying that, well, I'm behind you and when the time comes, you know, I'll join in and I'm working on it. And he was working on getting the American people to accept war by all this phony propaganda that was being put out. And of course we know that the British intelligence in a big way was operating in the United States starting in 1939 at least totally freely and putting out all their propaganda, doing all their intelligence work without the U.S. government in any way interfering. So I'm sorry. Continue.
No, that's quite all right. You raise some excellent points, and you know, it's also little known that there were Polish ministers of government and all that did not want things to go the way they were going. They recognize these diplomats and employees that Hitler's terms were very conciliatory, and they were not under the illusion that Poland could resist or even beat Germany in a war, and there was a handful of them. Polish patriots, if you will, who decried all those attempts to push Germany against the wall, to cooperate with England and the United States against Germany, because they at least had the sense to realize that the greatest threat to Poland was the USSR, and if Russia ever decided to come in and take Polish territory, the only nation in Europe that could protect them would be Germany. But those handful were overrun, just like those in England, just like those in the United States, by the power of money and the power of the media and political power. And, you know, FDR, as he's quite accurately said, was promoting all these things under the table. Well, he had Cordell Hull, his Secretary of State, doing the same thing to Japan, trying to provoke Japan. And one of the communications between Roosevelt and Churchill that Kent saw, and of course this was way before Pearl Harbor, was that he said, "Don't worry, I'll get us in it as quick as I can, and whatever, and if, you know, by any way possible." It's usually referred to as the back door to war, but that, you know, if Germany won't take the bait, maybe I can get Japan to take the bait. Things like this. So, and this warmonger, first-class warmonger, is presented to America and to the world as a hero. Schools are named after him. His picture's on one of our coins and things like this. And Churchill is treated the same way. And, of course, the most demonized man in history is Adolf Hitler, who was the most innocent of all of them, and was obviously the greatest statesman of any of them, and all his efforts to avoid the war, and he's been blamed as the number one cause of it, or the cause of it. And so history is so twisted and perverted, Carolyn, as you well know, that, you know, I think that the job of people like you, and others, even myself, you know, to try and untangle some of this web of deceit and present a different viewpoint that is much more viable, has much more substantiation than what the establishment historians tell us. Because when you foul up something, they see, you cannot study and understand World War II without understanding World War I. And those two subjects are kind of taught in a vacuum here in the United States, like they're not even related. One started, and then a few years later there was another one. But there could have been no World War II without the outcome of World War I and that horrible Treaty of Versailles. And so you have to learn all of these things to learn just how badly Germany suffered after World War I, because they lost that war and their territory was taken away from them. The phony nation of Czechoslovakia was formed for the specific purpose of Russian troops being allowed to come into the heart of Europe in case a war broke out, because Czechoslovakia was going to be friendly to the Soviet Union. And Danzig, the Polish Carter, East Prussia was taken away from Germany and separated from the German nation, and things like this. So when the National Socialist government started trying to address those grievances in a legitimate way, and very rightfully so, then they are called warmongers, and that they went out and were trying to start war by stealing territory, by crushing the poor little nation of Czechoslovakia, et cetera, et cetera. So the painting job, you know, the snow job that's been put on the people has been thorough. It's been successful, unfortunately, because, you know, I went back to school in my later years, you might say. You know, I was 50 years old. I had a couple of years of college in back when I got out of high school, but I didn't go back to school until 1991. And I got a BA in 93 and a master's in 96. And I was kind of just kind of taken aback the way things were taught, and I experienced that what students are taught nowadays about history and whatever, and it's so irrelevant and so erroneous that it breaks your heart if you really know what's happening. So
yeah, well, and you know, Dr. Wilhelm Crisman, who's been my guest, he has told me not to call the Versailles Treaty the Versailles Treaty, but to call it the Versailles Dictate, because
that's
he says
exactly
it wasn't
right.
a treaty. It was
yes.
a dictate. And when we go back to that, we see that, you know, Germany was betrayed. Germany didn't really lose that war. Through the communist infiltration and so on, they were working very hard to discourage Germans and tell them they didn't have any hope, they shouldn't continue.
Yes.
And then they promised some kind of an armistice. Germany thought they were going to have an armistice, and then they promised mm-hmm. that they would have some kind of peace treaty, you know, and it ended up where Germany foolishly put down its arms because they were trustworthy. They thought they were dealing
yes.
with trustworthy people. They put
yes.
down their arms. The other side didn't, and suddenly they were in this unconditional surrender situation.
Yes.
And they were forced. They had no, you know, they were taken over. They were forced to accept this dictate. It was all
That's
like
right.
a criminal operation. And it wasn't until Adolf Hitler had what it took and his group to overcome this communist influence in Germany and to try to undo all these wrongs. And this is why the British realized by this time, of course they had to, and the French, they forced the French to face it too, that this couldn't last forever, that what they had done was wrong and it was never going to hold forever, and that they had to start letting Germany take back some of this. And so then it was just a question of how much they were going to get back or at what point they didn't want him to go any further, because they were seeing that Hitler was really a real leader, a strong leader, and they weren't going to be able to tell him what to do and push him around.
Sure.
That's what I think.
Well, I think you're exactly correct, and I know we're running out of time here. One more point I wanted to make, Carolyn, was in 1943, and there were other times during the war, too, Hitler had his diplomats extend peace feelers through the Vatican to the United States, that this was getting awfully serious for Europe and that there was going to be a communist conquest of Europe unless Germany and the West would quit fighting one another. And Hitler offered to pull all his troops, of course this is way before D-Day, but pull all his troops out of Western Europe and defend Europe against the Russians if they would just accept an armistice with Germany, if the West, if England, United States, Canada, all those who were fighting him would just accept a peace, then Germany would assure that Europe would not go communist. And, of course, he proposed those things through the Vatican, and when those terms were brought to the attention of the American government, Roosevelt kicked them back in his teeth, you know, and said, to hell with him, unconditional surrender, we're going to bury this guy. And so that speaks of Roosevelt itself. And because of those actions, many, many millions more people had to die. And so,
well, Roosevelt was not an enemy of communism.
No.
He never was. And, of course, he died before the very end. And so, mm-hmm. you know, we never found out just what he would have done had he lived and continued to collaborate with Stalin.
Yes.
He was such a collaborator. I mean, he was like a fool.
Well,
and I don't think he was not in good health at the end. We had
yes,
this president.
You're right. He was a very Machiavellian politician. You know, the ends justify the means. And yet, you're right. He was not as shrewd or as intelligent as people would make him out to be. So
no, he depended a lot on his friends. He had, like you said, he had all those Jewish friends, and he was listening to a lot of Jewish influence. Between the Jews and the communists, and sometimes they were the same, I mean, that's where he was. And yet, because that's the direction that politics went following the war, he is seen as, of course, a great great man who helped the architect.
The great servant of the Sanhedrin. So, you know, he did their bidding and their will, and that's why he's lionized. So.
Well, my feeling after looking at all these things that you suggested that I look at is that it was very possible, and maybe I've already said this, and you've said it or implied it, that Europe could have, along with Britain, could have worked this out. And it was Roosevelt standing in the background, pushing it and promising his aid, which he did come through with, which discouraged any kind of agreements, treaties, armistice, peace in Europe, and he got this big conflagration, which he wanted, and
right.
United States came out the winner, partly
yes.
for a while,
yeah.
and
right.
Was ruling the world, you know, with the That's with
right.
the communists on the other side ruling the other on the other.
And in my
end.
In my opinion, England and Poland got exactly what they deserved for their contributions toward that world war. And, you know, a lot of my friends have really been irked with me because of my negative words about good old Mother England. But, hey, to hell with those people. They got what they deserved, just like the vainglorious Poles did. So their suffering and all bounces off of me. The real suffering was in Germany. And that's just my own feelings on this issue. You know, I just really appreciate the opportunity to be on today.
Well, thank you, Ray. I very much appreciate your contribution. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. Come back with us next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.